from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on June 3rd, 2008, in Janesville, Wisconsin. It happens to be the hometown of Congressman Paul Ryan, who had received a phone call the day before, a phone call that shocked him. For years, Janesville's economy was built around the General Motors plant. It's a city of 67,000 people, and in a lot of ways, it feels like Rochester and Kodak or many other American towns that were tied to a big corporate power. At one point, more than 10% of the town worked at the GM plant in Janesville. In 2008, the plant was producing SUVs. This was a problem because gas prices were way up and consumers were turning to more fuel-efficient vehicles. But Congressman Paul Ryan figured the Janesville plant could reconfigure to produce something else in the GM lineup. It wouldn't close, right? GM disagreed. On that day in June, news hit like a hammer from the sky. The plant would close and all of the jobs essentially would be lost. Paul Ryan was furious. Workers were devastated. Families felt broken. But then word came that the government could help retrain the workers for new careers. We hear about job retraining here in Rochester. In fact, it's part of the Anti-Poverty Initiative. And can it work? Well, the story of Janesville is complicated. There is no singular way to describe the impact of the GM plant closure. You want to look at statistics? Sure. The unemployment rate today in Janesville, or at least in recent years, has been less than 4%. But if you look at wages, it's a far different story. Look at how many jobs former GM plant workers have to hold down or how far they have to go. Look at what their kids are doing to help. And look at the suicide rate. The story is told by Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein. It's earned praise from the New York Times, NPR, The New Yorker, and more. And that's because it is not an ideological book. This is a thorough account of what happens when a big employer closes in a small to medium-sized town. Sound familiar? Amy Goldstein is my guest this hour, joining us from The Post. Amy, welcome to Connections. Thanks for taking the time for the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a special pleasure to be with you because I grew up in Rochester. So WXXI is my hometown public radio station.
Well, that means a great deal to us, and want to let our listeners know a couple of news items. First of all, Janesville just won the Financial Times Business Book of the Year for 2017. Congratulations on that. And want to tell our listeners that Amy is coming back to her hometown. She's coming 1 week from today for a noon discussion on the Brighton campus of MCC. So, Amy, what are you going to be, what's the format and what do you want our audience to know about your event 1 week from today?
Well, it's open to the public for students at MCC and other people in the communities. I think that there are free tickets that are available for people who want to attend, and I'm looking forward to talking about this story that I've spent several years researching, because I was interested in focusing on one place that had lost a lot of jobs, as you've mentioned, as a microcosm or a metaphor for what's happened in a lot of communities around the country that have lost jobs in recent years, including in Rochester.
Feels a lot like Rochester, doesn't it? I mean, Rochester and Janesville are not exactly the same size, but there are plenty of echoes here, aren't there?
There are, and what's been happening in both of these communities, as well as many other places in the country, is that manufacturing has been diminishing. And if you look at the kinds of jobs that were lost in the Great Recession, which ran from late 2007 to 2009, manufacturing jobs took a big hit. And that's why when I was interested in finding a place in which I could take a close-up on what really happens when good work goes away, I was interested in identifying a place where manufacturing jobs were mostly what had vanished.
Listeners, as we go throughout the hour, if you've got questions, and you may already have questions, you know, you may wonder if Amy Goldstein says, well, this is what elected Donald Trump. It's not quite that simple, but there are, I'm sure there will be things that she will be able to enlighten us about regarding that part of the story. We'll also talk about things like job retraining. What works when people are trying to avoid poverty? Can a can-do spirit, can philanthropy and charity replace or sort of fill the need that people have maybe without the government having to do it? All of these layers come together in Janesville. It's called Janesville, an American Story. The book is out now. And listeners, you may remember in recent months, we've talked to Brian Alexander about Glass House, Lancaster, Ohio. So there are a number of these kinds of accounts. I would agree with the New York Times. This is the most thorough I think I have seen. Amy, why don't we kind of work through this a little bit here? So let's start with this. This is Paul Ryan's hometown. And, you know, as much as Congressman Ryan feels tapped into his hometown, he was shocked on that June day to get that phone call, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. So the story that I relate in this book starts with Paul Ryan getting a call when he's standing in his kitchen one night when he's home from Congress in Washington, from the then head of General Motors, giving him a heads up that there's going to be a public announcement the next morning that this plant is going to shut down sometime within the next 2 years. He had, as a member of Congress, good relationships with people in General Motors. That's why he was one of a few people getting these very quiet heads-up calls. But none of them were able to do anything to stop this kind of hurtling towards the end that happened. As you say, this was early June of 2008 when this plant closing announcement happened. And it turned out that the last day of production at this assembly plant wasn't 2 years from then. It was 2 days before Christmas of that year. So this all happened very fast. And this was an auto plant with very deep roots, both in General Motors as a corporation and within this community. It started turning out tractors as the first thing it did when it joined General Motors, just after World War I in 2019. And it began making Chevrolets. There were at various times trucks and cars, and at the end, SUVs that were being made at this assembly plant. And those Chevrolet productions started in 1923. So there were generations of people for whom this was the best working class set of jobs in town. And it was a kind of place where fathers and mothers handed jobs down to their kids and nieces and nephews. So it was really a multi-generational attachment by the end that people who had been at this plant had to General Motors and to these very good $28 an hour wages that are very hard to replace right now.
When you set out to tell this kind of a story, a plant with this kind of history, a town with this kind of attachment, and you know, one of the most powerful members of Congress, this is his hometown, how do you go about the research? How long did it take? I mean, take us a little bit through that process, because I was amazed at the number of personal stories you're able to tell in this book that kind of helped put this together, Amy.
Well, I first arrived in Janesville in July of 2011. So it'd been about 2.5 years since these General Motors jobs disappeared. And with them, I should say, thousands of other jobs that had been at supplier companies that existed because the plant existed. And then when those two sets of auto jobs went away, other small businesses in town had a hard time sustaining themselves because this was in the midst of the worst recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And there were a lot of people in the community who no longer had their paychecks. So I arrived in town, as I said, in the middle of 2011 on kind of an exploratory mission to see whether this community might work as a setting for the idea that I had to take a really close-up look at what happens when good work goes away. And on that first trip, I met just a few people who I had thought might be the kinds of people who give me a sense of what had been happening. So I met with a longtime journalist in town. I met with two GM retirees who at the time were running the United Auto Workers local because there were no more active workers to get release time from their job to be running the local. So it was two retirees who were doing this as volunteers. I met with the man who ran the Rock County, that's the county that Janesville's in, the Rock County Job Center, which was a kind of ground zero where people turned to when the work they had thought would last their whole lifetime suddenly disappeared. So these were people who I thought had kind of pivotal insight into what happened in the community. And on that trip and a number of other early trips that I made, everybody I met, I said, who else should I meet with? So I got to know a lot of people in town. I also started early on to meet with people at a small public college called Black Hawk Technical College. It's part of a system of technical colleges, kind of like community colleges, but they just do the vocational training part of what community colleges usually do. And it was a place to which a couple of thousand dislocated workers turned to try to figure out if they could train to do something different. So these were kind of anchors in the community that I started to get to know. And over the next few years, met more and more and more people until I finally decided, through a fairly slow and inefficient process, which were going to be the main people who I wanted to focus on in this book. And the book came out this past spring, so I was working for more than 5 years on the research and writing of this project.
Let me Let me go ahead and read a tweet from Matthew Dowd of ABC News, among other sources. And this is in response to some of the results last night in elections. We'll get to questions that listeners have about, you know, Donald Trump and support for Donald Trump in communities like this a little bit later. But here's what Matthew Dowd tweeted this morning, looking at the national landscape after elections last night. He wrote, quote, after journalism by anecdote surfaced last year and was empowered after the Trump election, hopefully we can get back to data-driven mode using anecdotes to reveal the story. The plural of anecdote isn't data, end quote. I think that's wise, and I think your book is one of the best examples I've ever seen of that, Amy, because you found these compelling personal stories, but you also stitched it into data that makes it harder to just pin, you know, or dispute some of what we're hearing. I guess what I'm saying here is I think this is what journalism needs to look like. It has to be data-driven, but we also need to understand the personal stories, the human stories, because people are not just numbers. Was that part of the goal behind your reporting here?
I very much appreciate your saying that, because that was absolutely part of my goal. You know, in doing this work, I had a sense, back after the Great Recession was ending, 2009, and then next year or two until I really got going with this work, that, you know, many of us in the United States knew what the unemployment numbers were like, but we didn't really know what it felt like to lose work. So I was very committed to telling this story in a very intimate way. At the same time, it seemed to me essential to make clear that these individual sets of experiences that I was going to be describing were representative of broader truths. And that's where the statistical and the data sets come in. And I did this in two very specific ways. One had to do with what we were starting to talk about with respect to job retraining. So I worked with a couple of labor economists to do a statistical analysis of what happened to people in that small part of southeastern Wisconsin who had lost work during the period of the Great Recession and then either did or did not go back to school at this college called Black Hawk Technical College. And what we found was, on the surface, counterintuitive. We found that retraining was not particularly helpful, that if you compared people who had and had not gone back to school, all of them being people who had lost their work, the people who had retrained were less likely a few years later to be working full-time. And if they did have jobs, they were likely to have had bigger pay drops than people who had not retrained from before the recession to what they were earning at the point that we looked at this, which was about 2011. So it was about 3 years after this work disappeared. So that was one kind of data that reflected the experiences of people who I was concurrently getting to know up close and personal. The other statistical work that I did was with some folks at the University of Wisconsin, and it was a one-county survey. It was a survey of Rock County, which is the place in which Janesville is the county seat, and it was looking at people's economic attitudes and experiences. We did this work in 2013, so it was 4 years after the recession had officially ended and about 5 years after General Motors had closed. And we asked a whole lot of questions ranging from, do you think this country is still in a recession or not? And this time, 5 years afterwards, about 75% of the people who answered our survey said they thought that it felt like the country was still in a recession. And we asked questions to try to tease out how common was this experience of lost jobs. It turned out that of the people who answered our survey, just over 1 in 3 said that somebody, either they or someone in their home, had lost work. And then we asked a lot of questions of just those people about what happened to them after their work had gone away, what they did to try to make it financially, what their emotional experience had been like. So we really tried to create sort of a broader portrait of what the economic experience had been like in this part of the country, in addition to or in juxtaposition with these very intimate stories of individuals and families in town.
I take the book as a bit of a warning sign for anyone who is looking at job retraining as a kind of panacea. And I'm not sure that's a fair word. I don't know that anybody in the, for example, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative would call job retraining a panacea. But there is a lot of hype for it, despite the fact that, you know, Amy's book wades through why job retraining has not been effective for the most part in a place like Janesville. But that is also reflected in a number of other studies over the years. And so I think it should be a bit of a warning sign for those of us who would want to put too much emphasis on job retraining. So let's talk a little bit about why, because, you know, Amy, we could assume that someone who has worked at the GM plant or someone who worked at Kodak or someone who worked at Xerox, you know, maybe, yes, you thought that was going to be your job for life, $28 an hour, $32 an hour, whatever the number is, good benefits. Well, the plant closes. It's gone. You've got to figure out something. And at least here comes the government and Republicans and Democrats, as you point out, kind of agreeing on this, that, hey, we can get you retrained. But there are a number of different roadblocks, you know, sort of from person to person. And why don't you tell us some examples, including people who didn't even really know how to use a computer?
Yes, and let me just preface this by saying that I don't think that what I found about the limits to the effectiveness of job training in Janesville, Wisconsin, should be construed as a broad indictment of the idea of training people to get new skills, to get new work. I've done a lot of talking with people and thinking about this since we found our kind of surprising results in the analysis that we did. And I've come to think that it depends very much on the context of the community. If there are jobs around for people to get, job training is going to be more helpful. So I think it really is very circumstantial. But in terms of some of the limits and how hard this is, this little college in Wisconsin, Black Hawk Technical College, really knocked itself out trying to help these kind of shell-shocked factory workers become students. I mean, if you think about it, you've just lost your job. Many of these people, because people who had been in the General Motors plant and at the biggest suppliers, tend to have a very high seniority in their jobs. So these people were, for the most part, in their 30s and their 40s, which meant that they hadn't been back in school for half their lifetimes. Some of them might not have liked school, which is why they went right into factory work. As you say, the college quickly found that some of these people did not even know how to turn on computers. It was just not something they had needed to do in their factory jobs. So the college created very quickly computer boot camps and study skills boot camps and had family picnics for the returning students' families at the beginning of the year just to try to make this idea of being back in school a little bit less threatening. So I think that the college did everything that it could, that any college could, to try to be hospitable to these people coming back to school. But it was inevitably for many of these folks quite a hard experience. I mean, you've lost your work. You're not sure how you're going to put dinner on the table or keep your house payments or your rent going. And you've lost a big sense of yourself. If you've been a General Motors person for a decade or a couple decades and suddenly that work is no longer available, it's just a very emotionally bruising experience. And then to have to figure out how to start studying for the first time in a decade or two on top of that is a hard thing to do.
My guest is Amy Goldstein, the author of the book Janesville, An American Story, already an award-winning book, and she is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post. She's a Rochester native who's coming back here 1 week from today, in fact, 1 week from right now, next Wednesday, November 15th, for a noon event on the Brighton campus at MCC. Going to be talking about Janesville and the related threads that might feel a little close to home for a lot of Rochesterians who have watched similar stories about sort of big corporate giants and plants closing and what that does to communities, what it does to families. That event next Wednesday at noon, and tickets available now, MonroeCCTickets.com for that. Here is what Amy told NPR about so-called GM gypsies who took work in other cities. You said, quote, you know, there's this kind of mythos in this country, sort of this theoretical idea that when work goes away in one place, well, people should just go where the work still exists. And what I found is that in Janesville, at least, which is a place where people really have roots and have extended families, people don't want to leave town. So some of these former Janesville Assembly workers made big sacrifices to keep their family income going by taking jobs far away, working in Indiana, farther away in Texas, Kansas, and then coming home on the weekends or as best they can, end quote. So, Amy, I'm wondering, I mean, do you think progressives are too dismissive when they say people should just move? Or I say progressives, really anyone who scoffs at Americans who are steadfast in their desire to stay in their hometowns.
So I think that there's increasing evidence that mobility in this country is actually a little bit less than it has been in the past. And, you know, I have a very Janesville-centric view of these things. So what I can tell you is that of the people who I got to know in town, there were some instances in which a former Janesville GM worker took a job at another plant, because what was happening is that General Motors was giving transfer rights to these workers who had lost jobs when the Janesville plant closed. And in some cases, people worked for a little bit, commuted, found it very hard to be away from their family, especially if they had young children, and the family moved to where this new job was. But I also have gotten to know a number of people, and I think this is a prevalent thing that's happened and still going on, in which the Janesville worker started working somewhere else, often very reluctantly. I follow one family. There are three main auto worker families that whose experiences over 5 years run through the story that I tell in this book. And one of those families has somebody named Matt. The family's name is Matt, is Wopat. So Matt Wopat went back to school. He was training to become a utility lineman because the kind of common wisdom was that there were older utility workers who were going to be ready to retire, and he thought he could slip into one of those jobs. But it became clear partway through his year back at Black Hawk Tech that those jobs were not opening up too fast because these older workers had had their whatever savings they had crushed in the big recession. So they were going to keep working a little bit longer, and Matt and his wife, who was working a part-time minimum wage job, they decided that they were too worried that they might lose their house, and they had three kids. They didn't want to destabilize them. So Matt began commuting to Fort Wayne, Indiana in March of 2010, about 300 miles away from home. He leaves every Monday morning. He commutes with a couple of other Janesville guys, Janesville gypsies, they all call themselves. And he works second shift, which means that he works from mid-afternoon until 10:30, 11:30 at night, depending on the number of work hours that day. And then every Friday night, he and his commuting buddies pile into a car and drive home through the night, get home about 3:30 in the morning. And he's been doing that now, as I said, since 2010. He's still doing it. He's got six more years until he's eligible for retirement.
Wow. And so for those of us who are not in that kind of a position, and maybe from a distance would say, just move. Are we misunderstanding a way of life, a value that, you know, Americans in different communities sort of value different things, and some are a little bit more willing to pick up and move? And I guess I'm wondering if you think that we could be a little bit more understanding of one another, even if our values don't line up. If we look at a community where something is closed and said, well, just pick it up and move it.
Well, it can be very concrete things. In the case of the Wopats, Matt's father was at the plant, General Motors plant. Matt's father worked there for 40 years and retired with a good pension and benefits a few weeks before Matt lost his job in 2008. His brother and his sister are both local. His wife's dad is a widower, and his wife pays the bills. She writes the checks for her dad, and couldn't imagine not being there to do that. So it's very concrete, familial kinds of things, and a sense of where one belongs.
After our only break of the hour, we'll take some of our listener phone calls. I see the phone ringing. And listeners, if you want to jump in with a question or a comment, we're talking to Amy Goldstein, the author of Janesville, An American Story, just won the Financial Times Business Book of the Year for 2017. And it is a remarkably comprehensive look at what happens in a community when there is essentially a big plant that closes, a generations upon generations employment home for much of the community. And yeah, it rings true for Rochester. It rings true for a lot of American communities. Amy's work tells these stories in personal ways, but also with data. And I think they are instructive and important right now. If you want to call the program with comments or questions, 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Amy, after the break, we'll hear from some of our listeners. I'd like to ask you about a woman in the book named, and help me pronounce it, Christy Bayer or Christy Beyer?
Christy Beyer.
So a very sad story and an example of how Amy uses these kind of anecdotes to also illustrate what the data says about everything from unemployment to suicide. So we'll talk about that coming up. And we'll also talk about, some of our listeners want to know what Amy Goldstein thinks about what Janesville says about Trump voters. Or was it home to more Trump voters? Is this a creation of more of the Trump voting wave. We'll talk about that and much more with author Amy Goldstein after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, Walter Starr joins us. He is the author of the new book, Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary, a remarkable biography, a work of scholarship. And Walter Starr is coming back to our area to talk about Lincoln's team of rivals. He's coming to the Seward House, but first he's our guest. He will talk about Edwin Stanton, Lincoln's team of rivals, what we can learn today, and yes, the causes of the Civil War. That's back in the news recently. Walter Starr next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's grab our first phone call. It's Don in East Rochester on with author Amy Goldstein. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Ms. Goldstein, I've read your book, and I thought it was excellent, but I feel you left out two important things out of your book that may have made a difference in the community. The first was that I don't think the UAW was aggressive enough in trying to prevent the plant from closing down. In your book, they almost brag about the fact that they didn't participate in the 1937 sit-down strike, which led to the recognition of the UAW. They could have done a lot more to keep that plant open, even up to and including sit-down strikes, to prevent it from closing down. And secondly, I think you go a little light on Paul Ryan. I mean, Paul Ryan is probably the most anti-worker representative that district has probably ever had. I don't know much about that district, but I'm willing to venture a guess along those lines. He has been as anti-worker as anyone can imagine, all the way from, I know he's been in there since the 90s. I don't know if he had much to do with the North American Free Trade Agreement, but he's defended it. He's defended huge tax giveaways to the billionaires. I don't think there's any billionaires that live in Janesville, Wisconsin. So those two forces could have, the UAW could have done much more to keep the plant open, and Paul Ryan should be showed up for his anti-worker policies and attitudes. I find it ironic that when the Labor Day parade happens in Janesville, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan is invited to march with them. I mean, that's astounding to me.
All right, Don, thank you for the phone call. Amy, go ahead.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having read my book and thinking about what it all implies. I appreciate that. Let me speak mostly to what you say about the United Auto Workers locals. Local 95 is Janesville's local. It's actually been a very powerful force in town for a long time. And this local, the Janesville workers, were part of the 1936-37 General Motors sit-down strike, which, as you say, cemented the UAW as the labor negotiations for all of GM's workers. What was different about Janesville was that the strike ended early there with an agreement between labor and management for the workers to leave the plant, so they were no longer sitting down. And there wasn't the violence that there was in some other communities that were participating in the strike. But nobody went back to work until the national strike ended. And that's, I thought, an important moment because it showed to me that this was a community in which labor and management actually managed to work pretty collegially for many decades. And that's not to say that the unionized workers didn't participate in that strike or several others over a long number of decades, but it was pretty collegial. And in fact, at a few critical times, the union local and the plant management managed to work out some working terms for the workers there that may have had the effect of making Janesville less vulnerable to having been closed earlier than it was. And, you know, you can argue all kinds of different ways about who should have done what to try to keep this plant going. As it happened, the announcement that the Janesville Assembly Plant was closing came on a day when the corporation announced a total of four plants were shutting. This was a company that was in horrible financial shape. It was trying to shed workers in many settings. And about a year later was when, in an unthinkable action, General Motors filed for bankruptcy. So, you know, it may have been union actions, it may have been management actions, it may have been the economy or all three working together. But the results of what happened are pretty clear.
I think, Don, I appreciate the phone call. You know, my reading of the book is and I don't know, I'm not saying this to pander to my guest here. It's similar to how I feel as a talk show host, where sometimes the listener will say, you could have gone harder on somebody. My goal is to help illuminate, but ultimately it's going to be up to Amy's readers to decide if Paul Ryan either did enough or didn't do enough, or, you know, sort of a, I guess my read on that, Amy, is that your job as the reporter is to present the facts as you find them, and then your reader is going to draw conclusions, perhaps the Don drew or perhaps in a different direction. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. And even more than that, my goal in how I wrote this book was to try to help people understand how this very hard economic situation looked from different people's vantage points. So I wasn't saying that everybody should agree with everybody's vantage points, but I wanted to somewhat empathetically try to illuminate why different people in different parts of the community were taking the actions or making the decisions or having the attitudes that they did.
The book is called Janesville, An American Story, about Janesville, Wisconsin, which saw its GM plant close in 2008, much to the shock of that community and Congressman Paul Ryan, who is from Janesville. The story, by the Washington Post's Amy Goldstein, takes us through what happens when that happens to a community. And Rochesterians feel it. It's not perfectly the same, but there are a lot of similarities. And I want to work through a lot more of your feedback. Got a lot of ground to cover in our remaining minutes with Amy. So let me get another question from this one from Sarah. Sarah writes and says, did Scott Walker's push for right-to-work status impact the plant's status, Amy?
That's a good question. So Scott Walker was elected governor in 2011, I believe. So the plant had been closed for a while by the time he came along. But he's a very conservative figure in American politics, both a social conservative and a fiscal conservative. And he's best known for his views, which became evident right after he'd been elected. He didn't say this during his initial campaign, to try to weaken public employee unions in the state. So he pushed through the state legislature a bill that would take away some of the rights of teachers' unions and some of the other public unions in Wisconsin. But what's also true and a little bit less widely known is that there have been large cuts in the budget, including to social service programs during his tenure. He's now in his second term and widely expected to be running for a third term next year. So, you know, you can debate whether these are good moves or bad moves. He's very focused on trying to create jobs in the state, and different people have sharply differing views of whether his policies have been productive or not productive for that goal. So he's a pretty controversial figure. His policies loom large in the fortunes of every community in that state, including in Janesville. But because he was elected after the plant closed, he did not affect that decision.
Mark writes to the program and says, Evan, it just sounds like workers who didn't want to retrain. Should we maybe blame those workers? Mark, before I have Amy answer that question, producer Megan Mack points me to an article from Politico about Johnstown, Pennsylvania, a mining town. And reading from that article, maybe perhaps related to questions about Janesville retraining, here's what Politico reports. Quote, some of the later in life blue collar workers who are still in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, can be loath to learn new trades. We've heard when working with some of the miners that they are reluctant because they're very accustomed to the mining industry, said Linda Thompson, the president of JERI, a nonprofit economic development agency in Johnstown that provides precisely the kind of retraining supported by a combination of private, state, and federal funding that could prepare somebody for a job in a different plant. They really do want to go back into the mines, though, so we've seen resistance to some retraining, she says. So what of that, Amy, and what of Mark's question saying it sounds like the workers simply didn't want to do it, so it's maybe not that retraining doesn't work, you have to have a willing populace?
Well, the statement from the Politico article that people just wanted to go back into the mines rings very familiar to me from what I've heard from folks in Janesville, and it's not that people were, you know, dead set against trying to reinvent themselves. But there was a lot of denial in town, and I think in some ways legitimate denial, that this plant was really going to, once it had shut down, stay closed. You know, over the many decades of its existence, products, whether it was trucks or cars or SUVs, had come to the plant to be made there, and then the product would go away, and some months or a year later, another product would come in So this coming and going of things to manufacture had a very, very, very long history in Janesville. And when the plant was shut down in the end of 2008, there was a very widespread belief that this time would be the same, that another plant would come in. It was just a matter of time. There was a huge effort by, it was a bipartisan effort, by the then Democratic governor who had preceded Governor Walker. Paul Ryan was part of this, local politicians, state senators, assemblymen, the UAW. It was this very big multi-constituency effort to go to General Motors and try to persuade the corporation to give Janesville something else to manufacture. And it took about a year before it became clear that that was not immediately going to help. But even after Janesville lost this fight for a new product, a small car that GM was starting that ultimately a plant in Michigan was chosen to manufacture, even after that decision was made, which is a little over a year after the plant closing announcement, mid-2008, the Janesville assembly plant was on a pretty unique status. It was not technically closed, but in the GM and United Auto Workers contracts, it was given a status called standby, which meant that it was in a limbo in which nothing was happening at this plant, but it was eligible to be opened again if market forces warranted it. And for a little while, there were two plants in that that limbo status. And then for several years, Janesville was the only one in all of General Motors to be on standby. And I think that that kind of limbo perpetuated the hope of many people in town that it was only a matter of time until this this plant came back to life, except it didn't happen.
Okay, so I want to hit a couple other points before the hour is out with Amy Goldstein, my guest for the hour, who is the author of Janesville, An American Story. The book is out now, and you can meet Amy Goldstein and hear her talk right here in her hometown of Rochester. In fact, it's on the Brighton campus of MCC 1 week from today at noon. Tickets available at MonroeCCTickets.com. Before we go back to our listeners, I mentioned I want to bring up a story in the book, and there were many, but one that was very difficult, because sometimes we think about a plant closing, and it's easy to forget that there are domino effects. So in this case, the GM plant closes. Christy Beyer worked at Lear, which was a subcontractor that made car seats, and so people like Christy Beyer are out of a job. She decides she is going to try to retrain at 35 years old, doesn't have a college education, and fair to say, Amy, you know, they enjoy police dramas, and they go into criminal justice, and as you write, you know, they want to kind of get rid of their old habits, and they do want to learn some new ways, but even though they can graduate at the top of their class, they end up as prison guards, so maybe not the sexiest jobs what they had envisioned in the local jail, and they're earning $16.47 an hour, far below what they made before. Christy ends up in a spiral. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happens there?
Well, one of the things that I was interested broadly before I talk about what happened to Christy, as I began to get to know people in Janesville, was given the same economic trauma that all these people, thousands of people, went through, who turned out well and who turned out poorly, or in this case, tragically, and what accounted for who was able to recover and who wasn't. And in Christy's case, she had gone back to school with another Lear employee. They both, when you were saying they a moment ago, she and her friend, whose name was Barb Vaughn, both did very well in school and got these jobs, which were extremely desirable jobs, which hundreds of people were applying. $16.47 at the time was very good wages. They weren't GM wages, but they were good wages and good state benefits. So Barb starts working at the local jail as a guard, and after some months decides that she really is very uncomfortable in that environment, and she leaves and tries to find something else to do. Barb stays, and Christy stays, and a whole series of unfortunate events happen, including her starting an affair with somebody who had recently gotten out of the jail himself, an inmate. And she ends up taking a fatal overdose at a time when she's under investigation by her bosses and fears that she could be fired. And I've spent a lot of time talking with her mother, who's just, you know, heartbroken to this day that her daughter is no longer alive at her own hand. And her mother's belief, I mean, everybody sees things from their own perspective. I mean, that's sort of the point of the story. But her mother's belief is that if Christy had been able to stay at the seat-making plant, she would be alive to this day. I mean, there's no way of knowing. And some people lost their jobs and turned out fine, and some people lost their jobs and turned out dead. And I was interested in understanding the full spectrum of what happened to people after all this work went away. And as you mentioned a moment ago, one thing that happened both in Janesville and nationally is that during this very bad economic period, suicides went up.
I want to get back to your phone calls, listeners. I'm going to tell you, I'm looking at my notes here. We're barely going to even have time to get into the Parker Closet, the remarkable things that people do to help one another in need. I mean, Amy's book has those stories as well. If you've heard Paul Ryan on the campaign trail, he invokes that often. And those stories are there in Amy's book. But let me grab Pat in Fairport next on the phone. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi. Great conversation. I was just wondering if this is a really good time nationally to have a conversation about plant closing legislation that GOP seems to be pretty resistant of. It seems to me that when there is plant closing or any kind of layoffs, that not only are the workers affected, many times have to go on not only unemployment, but many times food stamps or other kind of assistance more long term. But also there's a double whammy to their community, and that many times employers will sue the local community for reductions in assessments of property, or like with Kodak and others, they'll actually knock down the buildings because you can't tax what doesn't exist. So that means that the tax burden for schools and towns, villages, all of a sudden now shift to the people who were laid off in addition to the hardship. And I think that it might be time for plant closing legislation to pay the worker for health care and for their wages for a year after closing, as well as their property taxes to the larger community, so that the community can adjust to the radical change in their local economy. And I was just wondering what your guests thought.
Pat, thanks for the phone call. Amy, what do you think?
Well, Pat, I very much appreciate that set of questions that you raised. And my goal in writing this book was not to lay out any policy advice. I wanted to show close up what really happens to individuals, to families, and to the texture of an old, proud community when good work goes away, and hope that that would spur people to think about what should communities and states and the national government do about this. So to the extent you're thinking about this, Pat, I feel like I've accomplished my mission with you.
Well said. That's for others to take Amy's book and make those decisions. When it comes to those unemployment numbers, some might be surprised at the Janesville unemployment numbers today, but this is where I think, whether it's Barack Obama, Donald Trump, or anyone else who just points to an unemployment number or percentage and whatever that baseline number is, we've got to be talking about wages too. Amy, what's the story when it comes to unemployment numbers and how it contrasts with wages?
Well, unemployment has fallen sharply since the worst of the time in Janesville. Early 2009, a few months after all this work went away, unemployment in the county, that includes Janesville, had shot way up to over 13%. Now it's about 4%, so that's a vast improvement, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, wages are nothing like they were. I mean, there's really nowhere in town, if you're a working class person, to get back to making $28 an hour, which was General Motors have been paying, or even the suppliers, which weren't quite that generous. We've talked about Lear Seating, which was the biggest supplier factory with 800 workers of its own. It was paying $22 an hour. I mean, that kind of pay just isn't around. So I think you've got to look at the supply of jobs, but also the quality of the jobs and the quality of pay that those jobs come with.
I think that is a concern in so many communities, Rochester included, that if someone goes back to work, that is one thing. Are they anywhere near their former level of income? And if not, can they adjust here? And so a lot of people may be wondering. I know they are. Our listeners are emailing to ask, is this a Trump town now? And are there conclusions to draw from that? Amy, what's the answer?
Well, this is Paul Ryan's hometown, but it's not a Republican town by any means. It's a longstanding Democrat-leaning old Union town. And in 2012, when Paul Ryan was on the ticket with Matt Romney as a vice presidential candidate, I was in Janesville on election night because I was interested in seeing sort of, you know, the hometown reaction to this guy on the ticket. And that election, 62% of people in that county voted for Barack Obama's reelection. 2016, 52%, so a 10% drop, voted for Hillary Clinton. So it was still going Democratic, even in this part of Wisconsin, even though Wisconsin as a whole voted Republican for the first time in a long, long time. But Janesville did not. And if you look at the raw numbers, not just the percentages of voting, it turns out that it was not a reduction in the proportion of Democrats. A lot of people flipped to voting Republican. It was a big reduction in the Democratic turnout last year. So that's what accounted for that drop.
Let me get back to the phones. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie. Got to keep it tight.
Yeah, hi. You've answered some of the questions I was going to ask in terms of the future. You're saying you don't want to really make a policy statement. But a comment is, frankly, a lot of these things I think get talked about in small groups or people who are concerned about labor historically and everything. But unfortunately, there seems to be a huge gap in turning that into political, you know, organizing of a grassroots nature. Maybe Donald Trump has scared people enough to, you know, some, in these current elections locally, there's been a few people running that have not run before, which was a good sign. People were more progressive, more a good sign because there's been the same old people. And a lot of the, you know, the Democratic Party seems to have this, you know, this kind of, neoliberal position that they really don't go after these issues. They keep on building downtown with giving a lot of tax breaks to investors while and attracting more wealthy people while the rest of the folks kind of have to squander for what they can get. So I guess I'm making a comment, but I also like a reaction. I think there's something just, you know, third parties have been pushing a lot of these issues too, but, you know, in this country it's very hard to get that kind of momentum going in a lot of ways. But there just seems to be talk behind the scenes, but not much major action on these. What is future work? What is going to be? And telling it a truthful way, you know, not just making things up and saying, oh, it'll be all fine.
Okay. All right. So thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate that. We're going to run out of time. So about a minute left. Amy, is it all talk? Do you see action? Again, I know you're not here to advocate for policy, but are you seeing any action on any level in regards to these worker issues?
Well, I think the bottom line is it's very hard to figure out what to do when this number of good jobs goes away. I mean, that's one of the things that I learned from spending all this time getting to know people in Janesville and looking at what the state policies were and what the federal policies were and looking at what's happening in Janesville. In Janesville, it turns out that there's, you know, a lot of resilience within the community. Have there been efforts locally to try to rebuild the community or to provide help through local nonprofits? Been a lot of fundraising to help nonprofits provide free health care or food pantry kind of help. But it's a hard thing to figure out what to do. And I don't think that no matter where you sit on the ideological spectrum, you could legitimately claim to have solved these problems.
Amy Goldstein, a Rochester native, a Pulitzer Prize winner for The Washington Post, and the author of the award-winning Janesville, An American Story, out now. You can meet her and hear her 1 week from today, Wednesday, the 15th of November at noon on the Brighton campus of MCC. Get tickets now, MonroeCCTickets.com. Amy joining us from the Post, and it is my honor and pleasure to have you. Thank you for the book and for the time today, Amy.
Thank you so much.
Amy Goldstein, our guest for the hour. Short break, and turning our attention to a different author, Walter Starr, back on Connections next hour. He is the author of a book on Abraham Lincoln's war secretary. The Civil War has been back in the news lately, not the least of which because of John Kelly's comments, but we've got a lot to talk about with Walter Starr. That's coming up next.